at ritual 8, which means that we are 2/3 of the way through ritual. So if you are interested in alignments, you would take a tape of today's lecture, Ritual 8, and you would play it after a tape of Nature 8, so that you would align Nature 8 with Ritual 8. Now, 2/3 is a remarkable quality. It's a remarkable ratio. The ancient Egyptian mathematics was all based upon 2/3. A man named Gittings wrote a book on Egyptian mathematics, which is reprinted by Dover Paperbacks. The Egyptians did not understand mathematics. They, for instance, didn't know all of the developments of mathematics. That was left to the Greek mind. And so when you look at the first collections of mathematical writings, they're reprinted in the Loeb Classical Library, Harvard University Press, in 2 volumes, Greek mathematical writings. But the Egyptians, who came a full aeon before the Greek mathematicians, 2,000 years before them, excelled in being able to apply mathematics, because they controlled the ability to find 2/3 of any number. They could find the 2/3 point. The 2/3 point is the place where on a continuum you would put your hand to have a dynamic ability to throw that form. If you have a spear, the 2/3 point on the shaft of the spear is where you grab it to throw it. You grab it in the middle to balance it, but you grab it at the 2/3 point to throw it. So that the dynamic control of a form is at its 2/3 point. And so the ancient Egyptian wisdom tradition recognized that if you're involved in a dynamic, ongoing maturity, you have to be able to lay a symbolic hand upon the 2/3 point of the form in order to give it a dynamic motion. If you're looking for the form that most interests man, you're looking for the form of oneself. And in order to find the 2/3 point of oneself, one has to know the form of oneself and its division into triads. And to find the second or the middle of the triads and see the end of that second and just before the beginning of the third triad. Now, all of this would come under a very complicated, extremely learned dissertation if we were to pursue it in this line. But let's transfer. Let's take this concern with the 2/3 point of a form and put it into our education for a moment. We're looking here to understand the maturation in terms of cycles. And these cycles are like circles, which by their very nature are divisible into four, into quarters. That the great cycle of nature can be divided into solstices and equinoxes. And that by taking this kind of completion, this seasonal cycle of nature and dividing it by a vertical, which is the solstices, and by a horizontal, which is the equinox, one has then a four-part cycle. If one is looking for the 2/3 point and you're looking for thirds, there has to be some kind of a conversion between quarters and thirds. One way in which to do this is to make a tripartite, a triadic division of each quarter, so that each quarter has thirds. And so four quarters of having three parts each gives you a 12-part cycle, so that the origin of a 12-part is a 4 times 3. It's a way to find, it's a primitive, early way to find a conversion between fours and threes, between quarters and triads, is to multiply them and make a set which is large enough to accommodate the two orders, and then one has a single calibration which can be divided both ways, into quarters or into thirds, but in units which are transmissible between them. So that multiplication in this way is a very primordial way of making this conversion, this transition. So the earliest forms of transformation, of recalibration from one order to another, were by multiplications. And not only by multiplication, but by its complementation, which is division. So multiplication and division were transformative vehicles. They were methods of dealing with transformations, multiplication and division. Whereas addition and subtraction, those phenomena were applied to the linearity. So one adds and subtracts in a line, but one multiplies and divides in terms of circles, in terms of forms. So when we come back to our education and we're trying to understand why would ritual 8 be such an important lecture? Why would it align with nature 8? Why will it align with myth 8 and with symbols 8? Because there are 12 parts to nature and 8 is 2/3 of the way through. There are 12 parts to ritual. 8 is 2/3 of the way through. So on for myth 8, for symbols 8. And looking forward to next year then, vision 8, art 8, history 8, science 8. So that 8 becomes a transformational node. And indeed, in symbolic lore, 8 is always a transformational node. In the musical arrangement of consciously delineated sound, one has an octave, 8 notes, and the 8th note is the repetition of the first note, but ready to go 1 octave higher, so that the set includes not only a 7-part development, but the first step in the next order. And so the octave runs do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. The 8th note and the 1st note would be similar but distinct because of 1 octave rise. And in this way, one can index sound to a scale. Now we know that there are an infinite number of musical scales possible. And yet, most of the development of the genius of music was based on the octave, which is a Hermetic scale from Hellenistic, Jewish, and Greek personages in Alexandria, because they took it from the ancient Egyptians and modified it in terms of the change 2,000 years ago at the time in which this was being done. as you can see, we can continue to go along these kinds of developments and develop a recognition of very powerful wisdom traditions. But we're concerned right here with the way in which this particular education now, this lecture, Ritual 8, has a poignancy, and that this poignancy exceeds the simple little coincidence of my pronouncing the word poignancy with the beep of a truck's horn. It's not just the wake-up call synchronicity of a truck's horn on my pronunciation of the word poignancy, but we're developing a quality of maturation. And when the maturation is full, it has the ability to transform. Maturation is different from adjustment to circumstances, because the adjustment to circumstances does not have to be full in itself, but only aligned to the context. Maturation is the maturation of a complete set, of a complete group, a complete type. And it's the maturation of the completeness of the type that deserves the word, the Greek term for this fullness was pleroma, pleroma. The complement that fit with the term pleroma was kenosis, which meant empty, empty. And so empty and full, kenosis and pleroma, are the Greek expression which appears in the Indic Buddhist formulation as shunyata, void, and tathata, suchness. That suchness and void are complements, just like pleroma and kenosis are complements. And that complementarities have a special, particular, peculiar quality. They always evoke each other when they are pure. If you have a pure emptiness, it evokes a pure fullness. So that a complete emptying, a complete kenosis, prepares one and is the actual trigger for the appearance of a pleroma. Put into pithy, little, memorable saying, a man must lose his life to gain eternal life. It's this kind of quality, so that maturation, fullness, includes a stage where emptiness has been completed, and there is a sudden jump from emptiness to completeness, a surprising, magical transformation, which startles one, which takes one completely off guard, which is a surprise with 500 exclamation marks. The complete surprise with all the explanation marks is Dionysian. The Dionysian quality of the surprise of life, the surprise that one not only lives but is viable, the ability to suddenly transform from death to life is a Dionysian moment. It brings, it triggers an energy of renewal in a startling kind of a form. Now, we're used to thinking of this, because of Western history, as a super serious moment. An ultra-tragic moment, because the way in which it occurred to us is largely conditioned in Western civilization by Greek tragedy. Yet it's completely possible to present such a moment in a comic mode as well as the tragic mode. For instance, in Ingmar Bergman's film, Smiles of a Summer Night, this Dionysian moment is presented in a comic mode rather than a tragic mode. In terms of the film, it could have been a tragic moment. And in terms of Bergman's work, it should have been a tragic moment. The protagonist discovering that his love is untrue to him and that his life is over decides to hang himself, and he hangs himself off the pole of a four-poster bed, and as he does, his weight triggers this bed to swing around, and it throws him into the arms of a new lady who is lamenting the loss of love, that life is no longer possible, she should commit suicide, and in throwing her hands up, her hands are open, and she receives the sudden body of a man who's surprised he's still alive and in new arms. So that tragedy and comedy have an equanimity. The tragic moment, the comic moment, have an equanimity. And pure tragedy and pure comedy are exchangeable, they're interchangeable. The fact, the dramatic fact, that comedy and tragedy in their purity are interchangeable, ambidextrousness, was the essence of the Greek mystery religions. Because only a mystery is large enough to include the fact that tragedy and comedy, polar opposites, are exchangeable on a level of complete purity and equanimity. If you abstract tragedy to its zenith, or if you abstract comedy to its zenith, those zeniths are exchangeable, interchangeable. The cry at that moment is indistinguishable from a cry of pain, from a cry of joy. And that particular cry, that moment of that cry, therefore, is not indicated by the sound, but by the sight of the eyes. And the sight of the eyes is that they are wide open so that you cannot tell whether what one is seeing is tragic or comic, because they are the same. These wide open owl eyes are the essence of wisdom, and often pictured in ancient Sumerian times as being open to the point to where all of the eye is pupil, all of where the iris would be, that the pupil has dilated so that it covers completely the iris, and one makes the eyes larger than life. And in fact, not only in Sumeria, but in the Indus civilization of India, in old dynastic Egypt, always the wide eyes of mystery were the symbol of this comprehension where tragedy and comedy are interchangeable, and the fullness of that maturation was the mystery of being able to be conscious of it all. So that there is a particular quality now, which has many depths and many mysteries, to the fact that this is ritual 8. This is the place in ritual where we can lay our hand to get a dynamic hold on the form of existence. Whereas in nature, nature 8 was the place where we could lay our hand not to get a throwing capacity, because nature is not a thing. Nature is a process. So where you put your hand on a process is to get the pulse of the process. You put your hand on a form in order to give it a dynamic motion. You put your hand on the strategic two-thirds point of a process in order to get the pulse of it, the feel of it. Now let's have a little mnemonic cue here. A process is where the energies are parallel, like these hands. This is a symbol of a process. And where they cross like this, this is a symbol of an objective phase. So nature is a process, ritual is objective. Myth is a process, symbols are objective. So that this movement of 90 degrees controls the syncopation between process and object, the process of a flow and its objectivization. Now you can see that this alternation, once one gets calibrated to this, you can see that the seasonal cycle has two pairs of each. It has a pair of processes and it has a pair of objectivities. The processes are those fluid event phases which spring and autumn, usually in a seasonal cycle, present. Spring is a flow above ground. Autumn is a flow below ground. The solstice of the summer, signified by the sun, and always the sun was either a crosshatch like this, or in later transformational symbolism, a circle with a dot in the middle, showing an objectivization. The sun in the summer and in the solstice in midwinter very often would be the full moon. So that there is this kind of solstice objectivization and equinoxes showing the processes. So that you have a seasonal cycle. If it begins in midwinter, it begins with the winter solstice. It begins with an objective quality. One can see that this is not at all the natural beginning of a year. This is a ritual beginning of a year. If you begin the year on the winter solstice, this is a ritual transposition because the natural beginning of the year is in the spring with the process. This is why a natural cycle, which begins with spring, does not begin with objectivization, but begins with process, so that all natural-based cycles have at their foundation participation in the movement of nature, in the flow of nature. Whereas ritual cycles always begin with the objective, and they always begin with the objectivization of what are we doing with our bodies in the ceremony on that solstice. Now, what is peculiar about all of this in relationship to Greek tragedy, in relationship to what we're developing here in ritual, because the second part of ritual, the second of three parts of ritual, concern themselves with Greek tragedy and with the Mindfulness Sutra of the Buddha, the Satipatthana Sutra of the Buddha. When we began ritual, we began with the sacred pipe and with Navajo medicine men sand paintings. That was the first third of ritual. The second third of ritual is here with Euripides Bacchae and the Satipatthana Sutra of the Buddha, which appears in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length dialogues of the Buddha. We are talking about today And notice how easy it is to lose track. This is why always, in order to keep track, ritual comportment was emphasized, but always had its referent to nature. Nature gives us the basic true cycle. Ritual gives us a cycle which we can keep track of, but we have to remember to make an adjustment, a 90-degree adjustment, so that the reference of nature, in order to follow along with the path of ritual, have to be constantly adjusted. What happens in ritual happens about 90 degrees after what happens in nature, so that ritual follows nature like a shadow would follow a form. But notice here, the shadow following the form, in that metaphor, in that analogy, the form is objective. Nature is not objective, it's just a process. So that the reality of a ritual, for those who participate in it, the reality of a ritual is what is nature actually doing. The process of nature at this particular juncture is the reality of a ritual ceremony. If you mistake what's happening in the ceremony as the basis of reality, you miss out on its true nature. If one is looking with the eyes of an anthropologist who is purely academic, and you're looking upon a ceremony, you think that by recording what's happening in the ceremony, that that's the reality of what's going on. But the natives who are doing the ceremony know that what's really going on is what is naturally occurring, and they're just keeping alignment to that. So there is a wisdom which we need to be aware of and cognizant of. Our ritual comportment is a way of keeping objectively before us what it is that we are doing, but the referent always is to the natural occurrence that precedes us. So there's always a mysterious quality to a ritual that's only available to be experienced by those who are actually participating in the ritual. And because you cannot experience something that has already occurred, the experience parallels nature, so that the mythic horizon, which is also a process just like nature, is where the experience registers, where nature registers is in its parallel, so that nature registers in language its mysterious goings on. And if the language is full, it will be able to exchange its quality with nature. Just as if ritual is full, it will be able to exchange its quality with the symbolic objective. Or to put it in a more natural integrative order, the symbols in the mind, if they are objectively full, will be able to exchange with the ritual body. And so what one makes symbolically will actually enter into the body and become a working operative part of it. If you make a ideational symbol in the mind of the heart being revivified, one can actually exchange that idea, that symbol of the revivified heart, and put it into the body, and the body's heart will be revivified. It's not so much magic as it is the reciprocity of the process of integration, which is there gratis of the way in which the universe works. Now, ancient men and women understood this very well, and that's how they kept the vitality of their lives. We have a whole series, a whole spectrum, a whole set of problems which obviate this for us because we live in such an ocean of ignorance that we do not even understand what is being said to us when ancient wisdom is just spelled out ABC. We don't hear it anymore. So we need to have some kind of a transformational template, a kind of a navigating compass to hold up, to help us see what's going on. When he was in his heyday, the filmmaker Michelangelo Antonioni used to carry around a blank slide. He would have a slide frame with no picture in it. And Antonioni used to hold up this frame because it was the same modulation, the same size as the images that would appear on the screen. And he would constantly recheck his vision so that he would continue to see in a cinematographic way the actuality, the eidetic limitations, the quality of calibrated form that would come across on camera. So instead of looking at the scene en naturel, he would look at the scene cinematographique. And he was enough of a genius that he could condition his seeing so that some of the genius of Antonioni is that when you look at his films, they are symbolic compositions which translate so easily into existential movement that one doesn't really experience the incredible art of Antonioni taking symbolic images and making them unfurl as if they were just ritual developments having almost, as one would say, nature. It's an art so great that it covers up its tremendous discipline and effort. So too, we need to have some kind of a frame of reference. The frame of reference needs to be one which actually will service for us to make a transposition between the ignorant expectations that we are all inculcated with and the mature possibilities that we are all capable of. So in between inculcation and capability, we need to put a resolving third, which is a form that allows for transposition and, at the proper moment, transformation. Here's the form. The form is a quaternary of self. On first level is the ego. On second level is the I. On third level is the individual. And on fourth level is the person. Now, as short form questionnaire, you can ask your neighbors, your confrères, your enemies, any population you like, what's the difference between ego, I, individual, and person? And from such a short questionnaire, one would find a plethora of answers, as the phrase might be. Easy mnemonic way. The ego is generally me. The I is always I. The individual is a balancing between the me and the I. And the person is a transformative completeness. Not just a balance, but a completeness of the ego, the I, the individual, all transformed into a unity. So that if one looks to find the form of the person, one could say on a kindergarten level, introductory level, that the form of the person is a three-part structure consisting first part of the ego, second part of the I, third part of the individual. But that the person is a dynamic form, so that it's the ego, the I, the individual, put into a differential dynamic motion, where would you hold that form of the self in order to, quote, throw it dynamically, give it a differential move? You would hold it in the second of the three parts at the I. Now, it turns out that the ego is always the ritual objectivity of the being. Because usually when someone says, me, they tap their body. Me. These, with two E's. This is me. This. Where do we wear the mask? On the body. So that the ego is like the mask level, which is on the body. It's the objectivity that's there in ritual. Whereas the I is the objectivity that's there symbolically. The I is in the mind. The I is the identity, which is a mental equivalency. Now, the individual is a balancing of the me and the I, the two objectivities. Whereas the person is a transformation. The ego says me, the individual says me first. Whereas the person would characteristically say, my relationalities. And there's a vast difference between these capacities, between these faculties. The ego is me, the I is I, the individual is me first, but the person is my relationalities, which has an exclusive quality which includes everyone. Now, generally, the traditional wisdom form is that the boy is the perfect example of the ego, whereas the man is a perfect example of the I. A girl is a good example of an individual. A woman is a perfect example of a person. So in traditional wisdom, a woman is different from a girl because she has given birth to another, or she has become pregnant and carries another. So that the woman as a mother, the woman impregnated, becomes the archetypal symbol for the person. They're not just me anymore. They are not able to be exactly I equals I in an equivalency. There's something else, something different yet apart. And they're no longer able to just balance the me of the ego and the I of the self-idea, of the identity. Identity and ego, even in very good balance, in very healthy individuality, is still not the actuality of the mother and child together as an ensemble, the pregnant woman, and even more so when the child is born. so that the birthing mother is the symbol of the person emerging in fullness. So that it is easier for women to understand the difficulties of individuality and the mysteries of personality, but it is much easier for men to understand the workings of the ego and the workings of the identity. Men are better at objectivization, women are better at processing. And when they cooperate together, one gets the whole menu. One gets not only the entree, but one gets the soup, the salad, and the dessert. Now, in this quaternary, in this movement, ego, I, individual, person, the ego always occurs on the ritual level. So that if one has a situation where you understand that there is egotism operating, it means that the function that is primary is a ritual function, and that the body is what's important, what counts. Where will that person spend their money? In a gymnasium. Not the old Greek gymnasium of the school, but an exercise place. Let's get the body toned. Let's get shape to the body. A sign of a very healthy ego. Whereas the identity is always developed through a sense of focusing on the mind, of getting the mind squared away. The mind has its objectivization, which means getting the ideas clear, which means making the idea of one's self, the identity, very clear, very sharp, well defined. Where will that person spend their money? On situations that lead to sharper self-image. Whoa, that's me. Yeah, that's me. This kind of quality, both the health of the body and the sharpness of self-image, are partial phases of a wholeness, which even if those two phases, those two aspects, or as much as they could be, is only half the story at best. What is left out are the processes. The process of balancing to make individuality viable, and the process of transformation that allows for the mystery of the person to blossom forth, to be born. Now, what is characteristic of Dionysus is that he is twice born. He's born again. The whole aspect of the born again Christianity is of a charismatic, sudden return to life out of death. It's very Dionysian. One is born again. This doesn't happen in some kind of carefully graduated development. It happens because, hallelujah. Because one has found one's way to the center pole of the big top. That's Carney talk. This quality is radically different from another quality, which is complementarity. In a complementarity to it. If one calls the suddenness of being reborn Dionysian, then one can call the planned graduation of maturity through a firm, steady phase form transformation, that belongs to the complement to Dionysus. And the complement to Dionysus is Apollo. So that the steady growth to maturation is Apollonian, and the sudden salvation of rebirth is Dionysian. Now, about 125 years ago, one of the most remarkable young men in Europe, Friedrich Nietzsche, wrote a beautiful little book called The Birth of Tragedy, where he brought in the complementarity processes of Apollonian and Dionysian. The birth of tragedy, birth, that tragedy has something to do with rebirth in a sudden mode, which is related in a kind of a vertical complementarity with rebirth in a steady, graduated mode. That steady maturity is Apollonian, and sudden maturity is Dionysian. And the maturity is not birth, but rebirth, double birth. Now, the song form, the language form which characterizes Dionysius is called the dithyramb, and the poetic form which characterizes Apollo is the paean, P-A-E-O-N, paean. Paean was the doctor to the gods, and so that form came from a long time ago. The Apollonian paean is in a complementation to the Dionysian dithyramb. The dithyramb is the origin of Greek tragedy. The Apollonian paean is the culmination of what we would call mystery religions. For the mystery religions did not belong to Dionysus, but they belonged to Apollo. The Oracle of Delphi is an oracle of Apollo, not of Dionysus. Apollo is the god of prophecy, not Dionysus. Apollo is the god of poetry, not Dionysus. Apollo is the god of medicine, not Dionysus. And yet they are intimately related because they're related in a verticality of complementation. Now we're going to come back after the break and take a look at the way in which the ego and the I, are very much a Dionysian and Apollonian kind of complementarity, but are totally polarized and separated if one doesn't have the synthesizing medium of the processes of individuation and personality to help them relate to each other in their fullness. A simple way of saying this, in a universe of men without women, they would quickly polarize themselves into warring groups where the egos would fight the eyes, and they would be evenly matched, and so there would be universal termination. Let's take a break. Let's come back to our concern. We're at ritual 8. And if we would align today's lecture with nature 8, which was entitled Cosmochemistry, there would be an alignment. And this alignment can be extended and will be extended so that by myth 8 and by symbols 8 and later vision 8 and art 8, history 8, science 8, a whole dynamic thread of graspability, the ancient Greek way of concluding an argument was to grasp the hand into a fist. Did you get it? And the grasping of an idea comes from the ancient Near East quality that original writing was on palm-sized bits of clay with a stylus so that cuneiform written language, which is the first written documentation of language, was always held in the palm of the hand. And so grasping the idea is literally going back to the old archaic form of writing, written language, for the first time. If one is able to grasp a form at its two-thirds point of its structure, one can then put it into dynamic play as a tool. A weapon is a misnomer. A weapon is actually a tool for destruction. One can use a spear not simply to kill, but to garden. You don't just beat the swords into plowshares, but you beat the spears also into hoes. By turning the tip of a spear, one has a hoe. And most early agriculture was hoe agriculture rather than plow agriculture. The development of plow agriculture is related to the development of the city. Urban people plow, whereas rural people hoe. The Chinese peasant always hoed and never plowed because they were primordial. There's a great deal that one can understand about reality, but it takes time and patience and actual learning. We talked about, before the break, about the way in which cycles of wholeness have four parts. But that the forms of actuality very often have three parts. So that the forms and the cycles must be modulated, must be brought together by multiplication, and must then be kept track of by division. That simple adding and subtracting does not allow for the modulation of forms and cycles. The cycle of process and the form of objectivity, in order to be held together, in order to be integrated, requires a weaving together of the threes and the fours, of the triads and the quaternities. That the triangles and the squares must come together. And so deep, so primordial, is the juxtaposition of the triangle and the square, that the superior form of education in antiquity was always the square of four subjects held together and the triangle of three subjects that were held together, and those two brought into connection, into integration, were called the seven liberal arts. And the seven liberal arts, the genius who put them into a book for all time was Andreas Capella. The seven liberal arts were meant to combat the seven deadly sins. That if you do not have a learning which carries itself to maturity, a devolution sets in and you will end up, instead of with seven liberal arts, with seven deadly sins. That life is an ongoing process, and if you don't mature, you will devolve. That we are set in this situation, and if we don't go forward, we are certainly going to slide backward. So that we are under the gun, as it were, that if we don't grow, we will shrink. Life is thus a mystery play, where if you do not learn, you will mislearn, you will unlearn. You will come to be more and more stupid rather than more and more smart. And this regression, because it is anathema, because it cannot be, is very often distributed by an adjustment to freeze dry the situation at some livable, tolerable level. In other words, instead of letting it go all the way to oblivion, one lets it go down to a stable, low level where one can take care of it, and that usually is a level of ritual. One can deal with the problems that are there in the body. As long as the problems register in the body, one can deal with it in a bodily way, in a material way. The higher form of dealing with the problems, dealing in an ideal way, with the objectivity of symbols, with the mind, is just as incomplete. The idealist and the materialist are just as incomplete. The Kantian, who believes that objective reality is in the mind, in the ideational, is just as limited as the gymnastic savage who thinks that the body is the arbiter of it all, that the material stuff is where the fulcrum of reality is. But in this development, in this quality, it is not the ego of ritual nor the I of mental symbols that is important. It is the fullness, the completeness of the entirety of the integral mode that is important. And this is why the Satipatthana Sutra has four applications of mindfulness. And the Buddha's teaching, the patient going through of the four applications is to disclose the entire cycle for consideration. Considering the body in the body, considering the feelings in the feelings, considering the mind in the mind, considering mental objects in mental objects. These four applications of mindfulness together allow for the attention to the integral cycle to be completed, and when that integral cycle is completed, its completion evokes a birth of consciousness, a rebirth of integration into differential consciousness. Now, this quality, this exactness of the Buddha is recorded. If we read through the Satipatthana Sutra, we largely read the Buddha's words. But the form of the Buddha's words, the form of his discourse, is of a dialogue. In fact, it is collected in the middle length dialogues of the Buddha. And there are large dialogues of the Buddha and smaller dialogues of the Buddha. That the wisdom of the Buddha, the language form of the Buddha, is that of the dialogue. Now, why would the Buddha use a dialogue form? Who else uses a dialogue form? Plato uses a dialogue form, Plato's dialogues. Who else uses a dialogue? The Bhagavad Gita uses a dialogue, Krishna and Arjuna. Who else uses a dialogue? The Hermetic treatises in Alexandria use dialogue form. So that ancient wisdom, when it dealt with maturity, with fullness, was always what we could characterize as a philosophic dialogue. That the philosophic dialogue is a mature form and process together of language. That the philosophic dialogue leads to The dialogues of the Buddha lead to it. Plato's dialogues lead to it. The Hermetic dialogues lead to it. The Bhagavad Gita's dialogue leads to it. What does it lead to? It leads to the rebirth of the person as differential consciousness out of the fullness of integration. Whereas a partiality, of that dialogue, where the dialogue does not complete its form, leads to tragedy or comedy. The dramatic incompleteness leads to tragedy or comedy. The dramatic radical completeness leads to mystery. Now, these three forms of the development of ritual interplay woven with language into symbolic recognition all have to do with the ability to remember. And polar opposite to remembering is forgetting. And forgetfulness is the key. Forgetfulness is, for instance, the Gnostic error. Not being able to tell the difference between a lie and truth, one has forgotten the distinction between them. This is characteristic in Hellenistic Judaism of the liar. The evil one is a liar. Belial is a liar. It's not so much that the devil is evil in the sense that he wants to get people to do bad things, but that there is a lie involved. The ancient Jewish understanding of Satan is that Satan is a neutered being. Has no gender, is an it. So that the qualities of the Satan, and in Hebrew one always writes the neuter article, the Satan, is that it negates the ability of men and women, of masculine, feminine, to come into a focus, negates them so that they remain neutered items that no longer have a dynamic and thus could never interchange, are replaceable by each other in a mechanical distribution, so that the Satan's world would be a mock form of life where instead of interchange and thus fertility and creativity, one just has manipulative substitution. So that hell is a paradise of manipulative substitution. A frozen realm where nothing real ever happens and where reality itself is forbade to occur. No dynamic whatsoever. Now, so deeply archetypal is such an image eternelle. So poignant is that archetype that the very aspect of a frozen ultimate in the universe stymied one of the greatest thinkers of all time. Albert Einstein was unable to believe in black holes, even though his mathematics showed that they were conclusively possible. Because before they were called black holes, this was before John Wheeler in 1967 termed them black holes, they were called frozen stars. And Einstein was Jewish. And to him, it was inconceivable that one of the ultimate realities in the universe would be a frozen star. It was the Satan's own kind of realm. Whereas Niels Bohr, who had no such compunctions whatsoever, encouraged a young Indian genius who had come to understand that there is such a thing as implosiveness to nothingness, Chandrasekhar, was encouraged, go ahead, think about this. And not just Einstein, but anyone caught up in, like Sir Arthur Eddington, the British cosmologist, one of the greatest of his day, refused to believe that there could be such a thing as a frozen star. There's no such thing. Well, it might abstractly be possible, but life would not permit this. God will not permit this. So good British Empire Christian, just like good European Jew, inconceivable. Whereas the actuality is a mystery which glorifies the very essence of Christianity, the very essence of Judaism, and gives it a poignancy, a mysterious poignancy. So our material can very quickly gain a kind of a sociological oomph. But for educational purposes, I'm trying to keep it distributed light enough so that we have mobility to cover the entire terrain. So instead of forming our attention into something which would penetrate through, I'm distributing our attention like snowshoes so that we can have mobility. I want us to be able to snowshoe over the entire sphere of education. Later on, when you need to, you'll be able to focus at any point on that whole sphere and delve into it as deep as you need to, as deep as you want to, and you will have no limitations whatsoever. For once you cover the entirety of the sphere of education and you go through the maturation of a real transformation, you are free forever to investigate whatever the mystery has and to appreciate both the tragedy and the comedy equally. The ego registers in the body. The I registers in the mind. The I is an idea of itself. It's always an equation. I equals I. Identity is that I equals I. A equals A. That's what makes an identity. But when you put it in that graphic formulation, A equals A, it also, in terms of logic, is not only an identity, but it's a tautology. And a tautology, a tautological conviction, is a psychological freezing. And the fact that circumstance wants to continue to go beyond that frozen frame of reference makes all of the energy that of life that wants to go on to it an enemy of the security of that frozen frame of reference. So that the anxiety of a neurosis is the misapprehension of the energies of life surrounding a frozen frame of security. And when one tries to cure the anxiety, one can only do it by freeze-drying the anxiety with a pill. Do not allow the energies of life in emotion. Ah, that's better. Now it won't bother me. Now everything is just as it should be, and I am safe. One is safe in a frozen star that has no life, which is frozen, a frozen star, by virtue of the perspective that one has. And what is that perspective? Outside of oneself. One is alienated from oneself. It's a very interesting polarity that now develops. One is secure by staying within a frozen frame of reference And that frozen frame of reference can only be determined, identified, as long as you remain outside yourself. Because someone who is in that condition, the term alienation, is perfect for it. You're alienated from yourself. Well, then how are you secure? It's a conundrum. And the best presentation of this particular conundrum, of the neurotic identity conundrum, was presented by Franz Kafka in a short story called The Mole. The mole stays in his hole, and he's afraid to go outside because if he goes outside, they will get him. But finally, one day, he is just so hungry, he has to go outside of his hole. So he goes outside of his hole, finds some food, and he's on his way back when he stops. And he realizes that while he's been out, they've gone in the hole and they're waiting for him there. And so he waits to see any movement in his hole where they are ready to get him. This is the state of alienation. You are secure within your hole, but you cannot go back to that hole because otherwise you will be gone. So this neurotic condition is a short circuit, is a tautological identity based on an impossibility. One could not carry it through regardless. So that it is a no solution continuum. There's no solution whatsoever. There's no alchemy and neuroses at all. This situation only develops vis-a-vis an identity, an I-ness, which has as its polar opposite a sense of the not-I. It's only when I equals I that there comes to be an identification that the not-I then is not-I. Not I equals not I, just as I equals I. And these pairs, these simple equations, I equals I equals not I, find themselves in tandem. And one is garroted on this crisscross. One existential therapist named Maynard Boss, who went from being a disciple of Jung to being a disciple of Martin Heidegger and developed existential therapy. Maynard Boss said that the cross of security tilts on its side and becomes the X of the unknown. And one is not crucified by the cross so much as one is crucified by the X. And that it's the precariousness of this cross that makes it dangerous because it so quickly slips 90 degrees and becomes the unknown. It's an existential therapy way of characterizing what happens. The only difference, Boss insisted, that the shift from the security of the coordinate to the insecurity of the fallen is always a choice. There's always a conscious choice, and the choice is not to go forward with maturation. The choice is not to go forward with maturation. No one ever chooses to regress, but you choose not to go forward with your education, and you by default regress. You never meant to, and yet it happened. And so the conscious refusal to grow is what makes bad little boys. As a little street lingo way. The masculine who refuses to become a man when the challenge is there stays a little boy, and the little boy regresses and becomes worse. It's this kind of a situation. Thus, the adage, a little learning is a dangerous thing. If you bring yourself up to a quality where maturation could occur, you need to, you must continue with it, go through with it to mature. And one says then, well, let's not educate ourselves and stay out of this bind. And the reply is that life isn't learning, is already a learning. We are all in that situation. It's the condition, it's the human condition. Balzac's great novel, Matrix, about the human condition, he called the human comedy. Because this is the way life is, and it naturally leads to maturity. And even by default, we can unconsciously mature. We can subconsciously mature. We can unwittingly mature, because life is just as well a comedy as a tragedy. They are both equal in the mystery of life. The identity, A equals A, is very close to and yet radically distinct from the balance of individuality. As individuality would like to balance the ego and the I, the body and the mind, the individual balances psycho and physical. The psychophysical balance is what characterizes individuality. The individualization is always a balance of the two, that the body and the mind together have this balance, yet the mind, the identity, the sense of I, is in itself a balance, an equation, I equals I. So that the moment an individuality balance loses its tilt, it becomes quickly indistinguishable and assumes the guise of the identity in crisis of balance, and the ability for the mind to completely captivate us and get us involved in balancing identity without our paying attention to it usurps the quality of individual balance by the preoccupation with identity balance. And because the identity balance in and of itself is rather an unstable quality unless one has a very well-trained, very disciplined mind. You have to discipline your mind to maintain identity, because many things contribute to losing identity or putting identity into jeopardy. Any external situation that becomes a crisis, your identity is involved in it. Eating the wrong food right away is an identity crisis. The body interferes. The body wants its due. So that the I-ness is not a very easy place to rest, whereas the ego is a much easier place to rest. It's much easier to maintain the ego than it is the identity. And when one finds that it's easier to be me rather than I, very often the settling in the regression is simply to be me. I'm going to decide I'm just going to be me. I'm just going to be myself. Which sounds mature and actually is the beginning of Pandora's box. Because one is settling to be me in a world full of eyes, which are sharks, which eat up those little me's very quickly. I mean, their mantra is supper. Supper. This situation is the ocean of complication This is what led one definition of life. Life is one damn thing after another. That it's an ongoing otherness to what should be, where everything reasonable in terms that I could enjoy, which is a complicated way of saying it's a jungle out there. So that the balance of identity very often is paralleled in an enlarged form by the balance of individuality, which is another precariousness, because one has so long dealt with the balance of identity that when the balance of individuality comes along, it's very easily mistaken. The techniques which one used to make identity are now used to make individuality, and by similarity default, one just makes a stronger identity and not an individuality. Precariousness everywhere. One would like to ask very seriously at this point, if one is a student of trying to develop, does anyone make it through? And the answer is yes, many. Many make it through. Well, how do they do it? And the answer is usually some form of the way in which the historical Buddha characterized it. They do it with diligence. Diligence is the only way, and notice that diligence is like an Apollonian form. Diligence is the only way, but due diligence makes space for suddenness. A superior, mature form allows for an explosive radiance that goes beyond the formal limits. A very beautiful Apollo makes room for the glint of a Dionysius to occur just the same. And so there is this kind of mystery involved. But let's continue here with identity and individuality for just a moment more. The balance of identity and the balance of individuality are often confused when they're thought of as the same kind of things, when they're thought of as belonging to the same set or the same type. Whereas individuality, as a balance, is of a whole different type from the balance of identity. The balance of identity takes place in the mind. The balance of individuality takes place vis-a-vis the body and the mind. And that the balancing of the body and the mind very often has to have its attentiveness to the fulcrum between the body and the mind. And what is that fulcrum? That fulcrum is language. The mythic horizon not only is extremely important because it's a natural development out of ritual, out of existence, but language is also the balance between the body and the mind. So that when one looks for the focus of individuality, one looks to the word. Language. Language is the balance between body and mind. So that individuality is characterized by being attentive to the way in which language balances, whereas identity pays attention to the way in which the idea achieves its stability. So that while an ideal sounds good, an ideologue is a very dangerous person. Well, the demiurge seems very sizzlingly creative. The demagogue is very dangerous. How can we keep track of this? This is a very severe kind of illness, requires a doctor of civilization sometimes to take care of. Because not only do individuals get in these kinds of binds and situations, but whole populations of people, tribes, nations, also get locked into these struggles and vis-a-vis each other. It's the cause of wars. It's the cause of murders. It's the cause of tyrannies. It's the single usurping cause of a whole range of ills that beset beings who are capable of maturation. So that there is a poignancy here. How does one keep track of language? That language has an indelible capacity to mature. How does language mature? Language interiorizes. And the first interiorization of language is with feeling. So that the first intelligence about individual balance is always in terms of feeling, not in terms of thinking, not in terms of insight. And what is poignantly difficult, it doesn't take much of a genius to separate feeling from sensation. The most clumsy truck driver can tell the difference between feeling and sensation with a little bit of encouragement. But the most profound professor cannot tell the difference between feeling and thinking. The difficulty is that feeling and thinking are confused, especially if feeling is not developed, that the intelligence of feeling is not given enough room to really develop and have its maturity. Thought usurps feeling very quickly, and thought's main concern, being mind, is with identity, not with individuation. And so one can quickly lose track of what game is being played. You think you're playing the game of individuality at the mind without even knowing it. Thought all by itself shifts the stakes to identity. And the symptom? The symptom is that somebody in arguing will say, define your terms. What do you mean by such and such a word? It's a symptom that somebody is already into the identity mode. You think that Grendel or Grendel's mother were terrible monsters? The freeze dryer dragon of demagogic ideation is real severe antagonist. And especially co-opts those who are swift of mind, who have very powerfully developed ideas, who have wonderful acrobatic capacities of thought, and don't have developed feeling at all. So it's extremely important to develop feeling before one develops thought. Matures the intelligence of feeling before you mature thought. And so a really good education makes sure that the body matures itself into the intelligence of the process of feeling before you give the really powerful ideas that give wings to the power of thought. You need thought. And thought is extremely powerful. Thought is so powerful that it indexes feeling by multiplications that approach infinity. But it has no protection whatsoever against the virus of self-infected identity tyranny without having feeling developed. And the basis upon which feeling moves, has its mobility in the process of myth, is by images. The image base, the images are the rollers, the ball bearings upon which the mobility of feeling is. And so images When they get co-opted by thought, the images are tyrannized into manipulated roles. And instead of images being mythically mobile, they become doctrinarily arranged. And you are given what you must think, what you must see, what you must do. And the tyranny of enslavement is quite amazing. Because the whole process of language is a process and not objective. The influence of that manipulated language comes to rest in the body. And it's the body that feels the anxiety. The anxiety, though it is there in the language, registers in the body. So the freeing of oneself from this situation is extremely difficult. What kind of language form shows the freeze-drying of ritual into a terminal death Greek tragedy? The Greek tragedy, which is based upon Dionysian dithyram poetic form, originally a poetic form of enjoying the exuberance of life, becomes regressively the seed of the tragic freeze-drying of feeling into a petrified body. The very image of tragedy is the wild-eyed parallel to the wide-eyed seeing. Instead of the eyes seeing all, the wild eyes see nothing. The blank stare of horror, with the mouth frozen in an eternal O, an eternal zero. And it's this mask which characterizes the very symbol of tragedy. The mask of tragedy is this freeze-dried, oh, with the wild, horrified eyes, blankly seeing nothing. But its complement, which is always there, is comedy of the smile and the glowing eyes which see through the tragedy. See the comic continuance that occurs. Both these occur at the same time, and so you see the mask of tragedy and the mask of comedy as a pair. They're always presented as a pair. By the time Greek theater reached the Roman stage, tragedy and comedy were so standardized that they would have these two masks over the theater or the proscenium. And there they would be. And the Romans called this simply drama, as if they understood it. And at the same time that you have the wonderfully comic plays of Roman drama like Plautus, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, you have in Roman life and death struggles of civil wars for generations on end. Only brought to a conclusion by Julius Caesar, who took over everything as permanent dictator. The only solution to the tragedy of history, of the constant struggle of strong men, is that finally only one strong man must survive. And that scenario evokes the murder of that strong man by his closest friends, because this is also intolerable. And so it leads to dead ends, which themselves are dead ends. At the same time as one has fantastic Plautian comedy, comedies of Terence and so forth. This situation becomes intolerable when it's raised to nth degree by late 20th century. Because late 20th century, crumbling civilization is radioactive junkyard. It has poignancies that have half-lives of millennia. Not just difficulties for the next generation, difficulties for next millennia. Because piecing it together requires so much ingenuity and patience, probably will not be done for a long, long time. Ritual comportment always seeks to found experience on the body, in the objectivity of the body, and in this ego quality, the meanness, in the meanness that is objectively there in the body, the natural maturity leads that body to speak. And just in that way, ritual leads to myth. It's not that myth always goes with ritual. It's that ritual raised to the right temperature is myth. The body brought into enough existence experiences itself and talks. So it's like a continuum. And what is that continuum? That continuum is the spectrum of integration. It's an energy spectrum, just like the electromagnetic spectrum. If you move along the electromagnetic spectrum, radio waves will become visible light. It's the same energy, just raised to higher frequency. And if you raise visible light to higher frequency, it becomes eventually X-rays. The only difference between visual light, radio wave, an X-ray, is its place on the spectrum, the frequency sequence of an energy continuum. So too, integration is a continuum. And the body, the feeling tones from a musical lyric, the powerful symbolic idea are all on the integration energy spectrum. And that spectrum needs to be considered in its wholeness, in its totality, in its fullness, in its cycle. Otherwise, all by itself, the stopping of that exploration leads to a natural devolution and a freeze-drying of tyranny somewhere recognizably down the path. We're going to come back next week and we're going to talk a little bit more about the way in which the development of Greek tragedy led not only to the appearance concomitantly of comedy, so that tragedy and comedy occurred together, but that in the struggle to balance individually comedy and tragedy, the development of philosophic dialogue came out of this. And the development of the philosophic dialogue became poignant because for the first time, insight form of language became available for recognition. And on this planet, in this star system, one of the all-time greats of using language forms that lead to poignant single insight is the Zen poet of Japan, Basho, whose haiku form is miraculous development. And so we're going to look next week at Basho. Not just the haiku, but Basho's haiku were always placed in a setting. And we'll talk about how the setting was a dialogue between poets to begin with, the Renga-linked verse, with the haiku as the seed of the beginning of the poetic dialogue, but the way in which Basho used the haiku in a travelogue, so that the movement of a life adventure, a travel, a journey, at poignant moments which he put the seed of insight there so that the reader could begin his dialogue with the poet. And you could begin to link your verse with the haiku, which were placed there at specific symbolic nodes in the journey. When Basho's journey, the narrow road to the deep north, leads to the place where one would see the beautiful Bay of Matsushima, instead of describing the Bay of Matsushima, he puts a haiku there. The reader is invited then to join his haiku with Basho's and enlarge. More about this next week. But the complement, the pair to Basho's narrow road to the deep north, the Oso Ho Sumichi, is Jesse L. Weston's From Ritual to Romance. Jesse L. Weston, who teased her sense of what's going on Nietzsche and on Nietzsche's closest friend, Richard Wagner. And Jesse L. Weston, when she wrote a book on Wagner's operas, on the dramatic librettos of Wagner's operas. What are these stories? What's going on here? What are these motifs that Wagner uses? And from a Nietzschean perspective, what is the deep symbolic philosophic significance that we're dealing with here? Jesse L. Weston matured herself enough to see that one of the most poignant of all journeys is that from ritual to romance. And that the synthesizing thread that she used for this was the Arthurian mythos, which begins not with King Arthur, begins way back in Babylonian, Akkadian, Assyrian, Sumerian times. And that the Near Eastern ritual origins of Sir Gawain are shocking and surprising. And Jesse L. Weston discloses, like a Basho, that the journey of the Western psyche to maturity undergoes a scale of maturation that even dwarfs the scale of the ring of the Nibelungen. Had Siegfried been able to hear the forest murmurings in their deepest rumble, he would have heard the vibrato of dancing feet some 4,000 years before, because there are those kinds of resonances that are there. And we'll talk about that next week.